meeting to order. I'm Representative Maury Lanning, Vice Chair. Representative Olson, Chair Olson, will be joining us a little later, but we'll get started. The first up, well, first we need to approve the minutes of April 6th. Would someone care to make that motion? Representative Wardlaw moves the minutes of April 6th. Any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of approving those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Minutes are approved. The first bill up today is House File 2042, Representative Cornish. Welcome, Representative Cornish, and we've already heard some testimony here, but proceed with whatever additional information you'd like to give.
My kid's ringing me on the cell phone, but I'll let it wait. Mr. Chair and members, House File 2042, I'm hoping this is just a formality. Like you said, we've heard it, and it's an elimination of a board overseeing a project on a stretch of river between counties. The county board is in agreement to get rid of the board. It serves no function anymore, and they haven't met for years. And it'll actually reduce administration and paperwork, and it won't reduce any protection from the river area that's affected. They'll still do enforce all the same regulations. In fact, more so, they just won't have the administrative meeting that they're not meeting anyway.
Any questions or discussion?
I think, Mr. Chair, we're going to bring it here because it wasn't formally brought to the committee before, so we're bringing it back to send it to the floor. I'm not sure.
Okay. So your motion, Representative Cornish, would be to recommend it pass and be sent to the General Register?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Discussion on that motion? If not, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Cornish. The next bill is House File 2187, Representative Abrams. Welcome to the committee. Welcome back to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a bill and there is an amendment, and let me give a very brief introduction. The Hennepin County Medical Center is probably the largest public hospital in the state of Minnesota and deals with some of the toughest indigent care issues that we face as a state. Under the current model, it is basically run as a part of Hennepin County. For 3 years, Hennepin County Medical Center, the Hennepin County Board, and various unions have been engaged in negotiations to try to set the HCMC up as a division within Hennepin County to protect the various rights of the employees and the interests of Hennepin County, but at the same time to allow it to be a little bit more entrepreneurial in the way that it does business. I have with me, and it's taken a whole lot of study. I mean, it is not just simply a question of one meeting and people getting together. It has been the subject of a thorough business analysis led by Irv Weiser, who was the former CEO of Dane Welcher, and a Blue Ribbon Committee. I have a copy of their handiwork in my office. It's about 2 inches thick. It has been the subject of serial meetings between various stakeholders, and it was only last week, after 3 years, that an agreement was struck. I have with me today Jeff Spartz, who is the chief executive of HCMC, to go through the agreement that was reached between various parties. There are a couple of participles still dangling out there, if you will, and to talk about the advantages of this new structure over the other structure. The proper motion, I understand, after the bill has been moved and the amendment's been put on, is for the bill to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law, because one of the issues that's dealt with is tort law liability to give this new entity the same tort law exemption that currently is in place for other local units of government. But at this time, Mr. Chairman, I think it may be helpful for Mr. Sparks to go through the bill to understand exactly what the concept is and its central role in preserving and enhancing HCMC status as one of the top indigent care facilities in the nation.
Thank you, Representative Abrams. The chair will move House File 2187 be recommended to pass and re-referred to civil law. Welcome, Mr. Sparks. Please give us your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Lanning, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Sparks. I am the administrator of Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. I'm appearing on behalf of the county board today to give some testimony. Just very quickly to set the background, Hennepin County Medical Center is the state's largest level one trauma center. We run the state's poison control system. We have the only 24/7 around the clock acute psychiatric facility in the state. We provide the service to about 135,000 unique individuals each year. And by way of financial background, over the last 8 years, we've seen $70 million in revenue reductions from changes in state and federal policy. Between 2003 and 2004, our uncompensated care amounts jumped by 38%. And that compares to the statewide average of an increase of about 30%. We had 34,800 uninsured patients in 2003, and in 2004 we had 45,800. We feel that this is a necessary change to give us some flexibility, to let us better manage costs and deal with the kinds of issues we have to deal with in a very, very competitive marketplace. 2 years ago, the Hennepin County Board, having seen some of the storm clouds on the horizon due to a consulting report that we had done, concluded that it was time to look at whether or not it was a governance model change would be appropriate for the hospital. About 60% of other public hospitals across the country have modified their governance over the last 10 to 20 years, so it's a trend that we needed to look at. They created a task force of 14 people from the community and the hospital, and our major practice plan. We looked at this issue. We came to a conclusion that modification of governance was in order. The county board then took that under consideration for a number of months and then later appointed a 5-member transition task force to work out the details. And the details that they worked out came back in the form of this bill that we have here. And we've worked extensively with the Senate and the House author on dealing with the various kinds of issues you're going to see in a bill, such as concerns from employees and unions. We've done a number of focus groups with employees to get their input and to do a lot of education on the value of this. And basically now I'll go down into the key provisions of the bill. First, Hennepin County Medical Center will continue to be owned by Hennepin County. The physical assets will be owned and controlled by the Hennepin County Board. We would operate as a subsidiary of the County Board. The County Board would create and appoint a group of citizens, 13 as recommended in the bill, to serve as the governing board of the hospital operations. The County Board would also retain control of key issues like the mission of the hospital. They would retain control over how uninsured care would be financed. They would retain control over the operating budget, approval of the operating budget of the hospital, approval of the capital budget and capital financing, and then a unique creation we've come up with called a health service plan, which would be created annually with public input to determine what services the hospital would provide during the following year. That would be done through a public process, and then the county board would approve it, and they would hold the board and the management of the hospital accountable for that. The employees of the hospital would remain public employees, eligible for PERA, and for the union members, they would be covered by the Public Employees Labor Relations Act. We would also be subject to the same regulations on data practices as other hospitals in the state. And as I said, we would develop an annual health services plan, which would have extensive public input to determine the service package the hospital would provide each year. Basically, the new model is not the entire solution. We understand it's only part of the solution. There are six internal operating initiatives that we put underway as a result of the consulting engagement that was done 2.5 years ago. Those have helped to stabilize our finances, but we think with the addition of governance, given the direction that finance has gone, that we will have a reasonable opportunity to be viable in the future. One last point I want to make is that over half of all physicians who practice in Minnesota receive some of their undergraduate clinical training or some or all of their graduate clinical training at Hennepin County Medical Center. We're the third largest provider of undergraduate and graduate clinical training in the state, and we also train clinically 70 other related healthcare occupations. Thank you for your time and attention, Mr. Chairman. We'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Any questions for him at this point from the committee? Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sparks, Representative Abrams, talk about becoming more viable going into this new venture. Specifically, how is that going to happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the major features will be is we will no longer operate under a civil service model. We will create a new HR system that will allow us to be more flexible. It will look similar to what the 501c3 hospitals have in the state. That's our biggest issue. The next biggest issue is how we go about contracting with other entities. We will be able to much more easily enter into joint ventures or into other business relationships with other healthcare providers. Right now, it has to be done in an extremely public venue, and most private entities that would have some interest in doing business with you are very fearful of getting into those kinds of arrangements.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Sparks, do you have some type of a business plan already laid out, or something that we could see of sorts to see where the differences are between the two?
Mr. Sparks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I don't have that with me today, but we can get you some documents from the task force report that would elucidate where we think the opportunities lie.
Thank you.
Representative Paymore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Sparks? Is that right, Mr. Sparks? I'm just curious about this relationship with the county board, that you will now be a subsidiary of the county board. So right now you're saying, and I assume it's in the bill, that the current employees will remain public employees. What if the new governing body decided at some point that they wanted to alter that arrangement? Would they come back to the would you come to the legislature, or would you have to get county board approval?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Paymar, I'm sorry I didn't touch on that point earlier. Any change in status such that the hospital board might contemplate would need county board approval prior to execution. For example, the creation of a subsidiary, a merger with another entity, all those things would require county board approval. And the county board would always retain the right in this legislation that if they were unhappy about the performance of management or the new governing board of the hospital, that they would have the right to either replace the board or dissolve the corporation and bring everybody back as a county employee. So the ultimate authority remains with the county board.
Thank you. One more question, Mr. Chair. But it'll no longer be civil service. So I'm just question about the future also. Would future hires then be public employees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, for the purposes of PELRA and PDRA, they would be public employees, not for other purposes.
Well, I don't get the latter part there about the other purposes.
Well, we would not be in a civil service system, for example. It would still be subject to pay equity and veterans' preference, but that would be basically the extent of it.
And they would also be get the same benefits as current employees. Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kamar, could you repeat that?
The question was, would the new hires get the same all the same benefits as the current and public employees at HCMC?
The bill contemplates doing that. The only exception to that would be for healthcare professionals who can bill independently, and that might be like the nurse practitioner, physicians and managers. If at some point the corporation contemplated wanting to give them a different retirement system for purposes of retention and attraction, with PERA's approval, those classes could be taken out of PERA, but no other classes. It's specifically in the bill which ones.
Mr. Chair, I assume that someone from Labor is going to be presenting to the committee? Oh, no.
Yes, yeah. We have someone from AFSCME who is going to speak.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Julie Glau, Legislative Director for AFSCME, Council 5. Representative Paymar, specifically to your question, for future and new hires, our members are protected under PERA and they are protected under PELRA. There is a specific exclusion written in. If you look with regard to nurses, and it spells out, and that's what Mr. Sparks is referring to, those employees that bill by hours. They're currently not considered employees. They would be considered contract employees if they're billing by hours. And there's currently under both PERA and MSRS, there are provisions to allow different plans to be set up. But for purposes of this legislation, our employees are protected under PERA and PELRA, current and future hires.
I have one more question of the audience.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, do you believe that this bill is going to, I mean, I'm looking at this fact sheet that the HCMC provided us, and just the cutbacks from the federal government and the state government and the uncompensated care, and the, I don't see any of that changing, especially given the direction that the legislature continues to move. In terms of capping benefits and kicking people off of MnCare and GAMC, GMAC, and I mean, what's sort of piggybacking on Representative Anderson's question? I mean, how do you, is the ability to join into joint relationships, is that going to be sufficient to make sure that HCMC is holding its own, or is the and maybe a follow-up question, if it doesn't, I assume the county board is still responsible and all, and as are the taxpayers of Hennepin County, to ensure solvency for HCMC. There's two kind of questions there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, on your second question, yes, the Hennepin County Board would retain the responsibility for solvency, and as a matter of fact, maintains the mission dealing with indigent care and the underinsured. Your question is a good one. I cannot sit here and tell you that changing the governance and making the management more nimble, which is basically what this bill does, is the be-all and end-all of what is necessary in order for HCMC to be able to continue its mission and, in fact, expand its mission into the future. What I can tell you is that without this step, the other steps that can be taken down the road will be less effective. And particularly when you take a look at the healthcare landscape in the Twin Cities, in which alliances are being created and joint ventures are going forward, etc. Given the current governance structure, HCMC simply is not nimble enough in order to be able to take advantage of some of those opportunities that present itself. And it's not just in the provision of care, as was stated earlier by Mr. Sparks. It's also in its teaching mission. So, you know, you are correct that, you know, obviously we cannot be in a cut mode all the time at the federal level and at the state level. But if HCMC is going to be effective in the future, having a different governance structure, I think, is one of the essential elements, not the only essential element.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the financial part of the deal, the financial advisors that are advising the county on this here, what is it that they have for a timeline as far as seeing Hennepin County come out of this? Sounds like they're in a decline. They're losing money. They're in a terrible state. What's the long range focus for this? What's the financial implications in the near future or long term?
Mr. Sparks?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Anderson, there's no question we've had some very hard years at the medical center. And without making too much of it, though, we did, despite all of the reductions in revenues, get into the black last year. And I think that's due to the fact that we've made some tremendous internal efforts at stabilizing our finances and reducing our costs without cutting the quality of our care. The way I look at this governance change is it's not the key to everything, but it's a wonderful arrow to have in our quiver to help us cope with the future. I can't promise you that if the legislature does this, that 10 years from now or 5 years from now, there's not a terrible crisis at Medical Center, but in all likelihood, if we don't do this, any really serious crisis is going to pop up a lot sooner than that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Abrams. If this is an indicator of what Hennepin County is going through, what's other, like Ramsey County, the Regents Hospital, what are some of these other county hospitals or hospitals like this facing, if Hennepin County is facing this as a large hospital, hopefully with smart financial advisors and people that are, you know, seeing the picture way ahead of us and yet they're in a financial. Do you know what else is coming down from the bigger hospitals?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, you've already seen it to some extent. The Regions now has a strategic partnership, I believe, with Health Partners, which I think is about 5 or 6 years old. University Hospital is now Fairview University Hospital. Hennepin is literally unique, at least in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, having the indigent care component and the teaching component in being an independent entity. In some ways it is a little bit like North, but the indigent care and the teaching functions make it different as a public entity. So other public entities that are kind of in the same business that Hennepin is have already gone down this road a little bit. And may I add, Mr. Chairman, this is not simply an issue in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. This is an issue that literally every major city has had to confront throughout the United States. Now, some of them have gone to a model of having a hospital taxing district and simply have everybody in the metropolitan area have to pay property taxes in order to pay for the care. That isn't going to work here, simply because of where the county lines are and given the unique history. But providing indigent care and the teaching hospital and being a teaching hospital literally is a national problem, and there are a number of causes of it, and we think that this is a part of the answer for Hennepin County Medical Center, certainly not the entire answer, Representative Anderson, but certainly a part of a comprehensive answer.
Thank you.
I see that we have some others who wish to testify on this bill. First of all, Chair of the Hennepin County Commissioner Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Randy Johnson, and I'm a Hennepin County Commissioner and Chair of the Hennepin County Board, and I very strongly support this bill. There's been a lot of work and effort that's gone into it with the authors. Representative Abrams and I have discussed this over several years. I'm a very, very strong and passionate supporter of the Hennepin County Medical Center. It provides quality care for all in our community and throughout the state of Minnesota. And it also is one of the premier teaching hospitals in the entire country. We managed to attract some of the very best medical talent, physicians, doctors, and others out of the very best medical schools and professional schools who come here for residencies, come here for further training. And I tell people sometimes only half in jest that many of them come here for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years of training and plan on going back to where they came from or someplace else. But if we can help them get through that second winter, they tend to stay here in Minnesota. And that's the reason that we have so many people who are practicing healthcare professionals who received advanced training at HCMC, that they were attracted here. And that's good for all of us. It raises the level of the quality of care for people throughout the state of Minnesota. I support this, and I think that the questions from Representative Anderson, Representative Paymar, and others, is this going to be the final solution? Is this the structural change that now is going to solve the healthcare problems of HCMC? And I wish I could say that it is, but it's more complicated than that. I think what I can say is if we don't make these kinds of changes, it will become impossible for HCMC to survive as the kind of quality teaching hospital and quality care hospital that it has been for so long. So I strongly support it.
Questions for Commissioner Johnson. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Johnson, I first wanted to thank you and commend you and the county board for your work with AFSCME on this. And that, you know, going into this process, that was my major concern, and I'm glad that you addressed it. I just had a couple of questions on the governance issues. And on page 3 of the bill, lines 9 through 12, this is appointment of board members. There's discussion of a slate. Initially, the county board would nominate a slate, and then thereafter, the slate would be nominated by a committee of the board itself. My concern here is I wanted to make sure that some of the major community stakeholders in HCMC would have representation on the board. You know, people in the community, you know, some of the clinics, others, even folks in the medical profession. Has the county board given thought to ensuring through this process that some of the key stakeholders in HCMC will be on the board, you know, if not in perpetuity in terms of figuring in a, you know, specific mandate for that, but do you have some thoughts on that?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, yes, we've had some informal discussions. One of the reasons for making the change is to get more involvement of stakeholders rather than just the 7 county commissioners who may or may not represent all parts of the community. We think that this provides a much better opportunity to do that and still have the final control over major strategic decisions and bonding be in the hands of the elected county board.
Thank you.
There are no other questions. Commissioner Johnson, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Abrams, we still have a couple others, I believe, that are scheduled to testify.
They may not be as favorable, Mr. Chairman, but they're... we have Elliot Side from AFSCME is also here.
Okay. Mr. Side, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Representative Lanning, Mr. Chairman, I'm Elliot Side. I'm the director of AFSCME Council 5, representing 40,000 state and local government employees throughout Minnesota. Thank you for having me at your committee today.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members, AFSCME strongly supports this bill as now written and amended. We were very concerned about the public mission and the mission of the hospital, being able to continue to serve people in the community, continue to serve those who can't afford care, the ability to continue to produce docs for the state of Minnesota, and the mission is preserved as an academic teaching hospital. It does train the majority of docs, and it maintains that mission for uninsured and underinsured individuals. It makes sure that the hospital is public and stays public and meets every test that's been contested. In previous cases, there have been many cases where there have been contesting of the public nature of the facility. We believe this bill has language that makes sure that in the case of a potential challenge by anyone, if this is a public facility or not, it will meet all those tests and continue to be a public facility. The employees are governed by the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. And I do want to say, Mr. Chairman and members, our members are not there just for status quo. Our members are there to take care of their patients. And they are very concerned about that. They were concerned about their ability to continue to be able to do that. And as I like to say in a lot of these meetings, workers will embrace change, Mr. Chairman, if they have a sense of security. This bill gives them that sense of security. They're under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. They are essential employees under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, which means they don't have a right to strike. And you will not hear me probably coming before this committee or any other saying employees should be essential and not have the right to strike. But I'll tell you, these employees want to maintain the mission of this facility, even if there's a labor dispute. So essentiality is built in the bill. There is no strike clause. And workers would have a dispute resolution mechanism under the essential employee area of the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. It protects the employees' pensions, current and future, under the PRA and the Public Employee Retirement Act. We think that's very critical for the employees, particularly in our classifications, to continue to have a defined benefit plan. They're very low-paid employees, and that's very critical to the success their economic futures and their sound retirements. So with all those pieces in it, Mr. Chairman and members, AFSCME Council 5 supports, and I would say enthusiastically supports, this bill and asks it to move forward through the process. We thank Representative Abrams, Senator Berglund, Commissioner Randy Johnson. I do want to note, I think this kind of bill and the spirit that went into it shows that all parties can act on a nonpartisan, bipartisan, multipartisan basis. That has nothing to do with partisan politics, but trying to do what's best for the community and the employees. We think we've accomplished this here.
Thank you, Mr. Side. Others on the committee wish to ask any questions of this witness? If not, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Any other testifiers, Representative Abrams, on your behalf?
Not on my behalf, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I understand Mark Anfinson is also wishing to testify. Welcome, Mr. Anfinson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, the trade association of all the state's newspapers. Representative Abrams mentioned a minute ago that not all the other witnesses may be as favorable to the bill. I am not among the number that he was referring to. We understand the dramatically changed environment that Hennepin County Medical Center and other public hospitals are dealing with. And we think the county board and Representative Abrams and other proponents deserve much praise for trying to deal with this creatively, as they are. The concern we continue to have is that one portion of the bill completely exempts the new creation, the new entity, from the state open meeting law and from the Data Practices Act, the state open records law. We think that goes too far. We're not here to say that some kind of an accommodation is not possible. The proponents of the bill have told us they think it is, and we are working with them, and we're optimistic by the time that civil law hears the bill, we will report success. So I appreciate that willingness to work on this issue, and that's all my testimony consists of today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Anfinson. Any questions for him?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either for or against this bill? Yes, please come forward. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Reese Ledger. I'm the Director of Organizing and Special Projects for Teamsters Joint Council 32. I am here today on behalf of our 75,000 members and retirees to offer qualified support for HF 2187. The Teamsters wholeheartedly endorse the protections the bill grants to HCMC's hourly employees. However, HF 2187 discriminates against managers and supervisors prove to be most integral to the success of Hennepin Healthcare Systems, excuse me, Incorporated. Any corporation's efficiency and competitiveness rely upon its frontline management, which is counted upon to enforce policies and implement plans. Typically, corporations reward those willing to take on managerial and supervisory responsibilities. HF 2187 would do just the opposite. It would deprive managers and supervisors of two fundamental rights extended to hourly employees. Namely, managers and supervisors would be denied the opportunity to organize and bargain collectively. In effect, they will be penalized for assuming responsibility for Hennepin Healthcare System's success. HF 2187 goes to great lengths to impose those penalties on responsibility, efficiency, and competitiveness. It creates a public corporation to bestow public employee status upon hourly employees and hourly employees alone. It justifies limiting the rights of managers and supervisors by citing the need to preserve the HCMC status quo. Somehow, HF 2187 forgets that the status quo is precisely the problem it seeks to remedy. Managers and supervisors will be at the forefront of the change necessary to protect the legacy of HCMC and ensure the success of Hennepin Health Systems. Denying managers and supervisors the same public employee rights afforded to hourly workers is misguided and counterproductive. They are all in the public service. They all deserve the same rights. Admittedly, Ty McKinster, whose only experience with hospitals has been as a patient. Joining us today are two HCMC supervisors, Angus Hayes and Lewis Coleman, who can provide more insight into their responsibilities and explain how union representation would strengthen their roles. Angus. Mr. Chairman, committee members, Angus Hayes.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Hayes, was it?
Yes, it is. Thank
please,
you.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chair, committee members, senators. My name is Angus Hayes, and I'm a supervisor for Environmental Service Department at HCMC. And I am very proud of the work that we do and the contributions we have made to HCMC's excellent reputation. I was honored when the Joint Commission for Accreditation and Healthcare Organizations recent mock survey found that HCMC was one of the cleanest hospitals of 34 plus hospitals that it had evaluated in Minnesota. And I was also grateful when the Commission's representative stated that we would be applauded and appreciated for our excellent work. But while our co-workers clapped their hands, HCMC tightened their screws. Instead of the support and appreciation that we received threats and intimidation. HCMC spent thousands of taxpayers' dollars to hire its second consultant in 2 years to evaluate our department. The findings of the second consultant were the same as the first. We were found to be doing an outstanding job with the resources provided to us. In fact, we were found to be doing such an efficient work that neither consultants could establish a cost advantage to outsourcing our department. But that didn't stop them from further harassing and demoralizing us. We were told that HCMC would continue to spend taxpayers' dollars on consultants until one finally was provided a reason to outsource our department and eliminate our jobs. We were forced to make a presentation to our administrator to justify our continued employment and prove our commitment to change, and still got to go through some things. You know, my question is why? You know, why would HCMC want to get rid of us or fire us when it's the consultants compliment our work? And why would HCMC want to change our department or management or supervisory when the commission says we're Minnesota's best? And I believe without a voice and without a union for the management and supervisory staff and the line workers, I mean, we don't have a voice like they have a voice. And we can just be thrown out on the streets in 5 days. And we also have family and everything as well. And I'm kind of choked up here because it hurts. HCMC managers and supervisors, we deserve better. We go all out to try and get the employees to do what they do. Matter of fact, the employees come to look for us for the direction to do what they do. So I agree with what that guy was saying about how ACMC employees brought it to the point to where it is. But they needed direction from someone to get to that point. And we don't have anyone to go to. Or we need a voice. And I believe we need a voice in the public service. And we all deserve the same rights. And we work just as hard as everyone else do. So that's my plea. I hope you hear me. That's my cry. I hope that it works out for us. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Any questions for Mr. Hayes?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hayes. Mr. Hayes?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Mr. Hayes, how many employees are there in your line of work
department only?
Or throughout the whole system that fall in the same category you were just speaking about?
Mr. Hayes?
There's thousands of employees, but I think there's quite a few, maybe hundreds, supervisors, managers, that are not protected or don't have a voice. I'm not sure the total number, but I know there's quite a few.
How many are in your, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hayes, how many are in your specific area that you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Anderson, I believe there's 170 of our employees that we employ. And there is now, since reduction, we have, I believe, 8 supervisors for that.
Thank you.
Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out for the benefit of members of the committee that under the Charitable Hospitals Act, supervisors currently do not have the right to organize. And basically nothing is changing under this bill. What this bill does is it does protect the status quo vis-a-vis the organized employees, mainly AFSCME employees, but it also preserves the status quo vis-a-vis supervisors. And, you know, I just learned about this issue in the last 4 hours, but to be fair to my friends in the Teamsters, they didn't reach an agreement, or the other parties didn't reach an agreement until last week. So it things are coming late, I guess, on both sides.
Mr. Ledger, did you wish to add something further?
I guess two things. One, just if we're going to be applying power to HCMC or to Hamilton Healthcare Systems, we should be applying power to HCMC. And help Hennepin Healthcare Systems. The idea that we pick and choose public employee rights, to me, is problematic. I would think that it would also be problematic to other unions that represent public employees. We have a public employee local within the Teamsters that represents managers and supervisors, as do the other unions that represent public employees. We just think that if to pick and choose between job classifications when everybody is in fact in the public service is problematic. I'd also just like, with respect to Representative Abrams, we have been working with the county and with the coalition of unions that has been pursuing this issue for the last 3 months. So clearly there are those that have had our message communicated and our concerns communicated, and there are those that have not heard our concerns.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either for or against Well, Representative Cornish, did you have a question?
Yeah, a question, Mr. Chair, for anybody that can answer. And just a little clarification. Before this reorganization that's proposed in this House file, are the regular workers already covered under some organization or agreement, and we're just continuing that, and it would be a new thing to add managerial and supervisors, or is everybody out of an organization of a union right now under... up under FELRA or
Representative Abrams?
While we have the chief executive of the hospital explain the precise nature of the bargaining situation, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Sparks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, we currently have basically 3 AFSCME units representing about 850 employees out of about 4,000 full and part-time employees. And then we have another unit that represents our paramedics, about 120 of them, and then we have a couple of small units for trades and other employees in the skilled labor areas, and that is it, basically. And then we also have another small unit asked me to represent some technical employees, some in IT, some who do biomedical electronic work, so on and so forth. So we have about 1,000 organized employees out of about 4,000. But no managers are organized now.
Mr. Chair, what we're saying is we are putting some people under the protection of PELRA or organization that it hadn't had in protection before.
Representative Cornish, we are not contemplating any change from that which exists at this moment in time. And that's how the language in this bill is constructed, that those people who currently have the right to organize and bargain, that continues as we go forward. Those who do not, under the current arrangement, would not going forward.
Just to still a little bit of confusion here. What I'm getting at is wondering if this person's, this man had, his argument had any merit. I mean, are the managers and supervisors the only ones that are being left out of the protection of a union? I mean, are you putting the people that already had the protection in this new organizational and the people that didn't have it, are you giving them, are manager and supervisor the only ones being left out? Did everybody have it before and they're just being transferred over into PELRA?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, basically those who currently have protections to organize continue in the future. Those who do not have protections do not have that protection in the future. Does that answer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So the managers and supervisors that want to come under the coverage of a union now would be something they didn't have before, and they want it now under this. They want to be included in this organization. I understand now.
Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard, either for or against this bill? If not, the discussion...
Chairman, there also is the amendment to put the bill into the shape. I believe it's the A1 amendment.
Okay, the chair will move the A1 amendment.
Is that our amendment?
Okay.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Discussion to the bill as amended.
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Representative Abrams, if you could just tell us what the amendment did.
The amendment, Mr. Chairman and Mr. and Representative Garofalo, does a number of things. I think that Mr. Scandrett can go through and describe it. When legislative history, when House File 2187 was first introduced, it was introduced mainly as a placeholder because these negotiations have been ongoing for a while. And what the amendment does is it puts in place the agreement that was reached by most but not all of the stakeholders. Mr. Scangret can go through what the amendment does.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Garofalo.
Just to say the committee time, I just wanted to make sure there wasn't any. Of course, every amendment has substance to it, but in terms of did it substantially change any of the items that we were referring to earlier in our previous discussions today?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, we have been describing the bill to you as if it had been previously amended, Representative Garofalo.
If
it isn't, I'll tell you that I'll be the first one to clean it up.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, that's, I guess, the only question I had. That's good enough for me. So thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, I don't have a big heartburn about not including managers and supervisors in this new unit. Is covered under the union, but I do, if they're prohibited from organizing. In other words, if this change takes place, could the managers and supervisors come in under the existing PELRA law or public employment law and try to organize and have a vote and organize? Or does this amendment from line 7 to 9 on page 2 prohibit that? It seems not very union friendly. I was wondering if they're still allowed to try to organize once they come in.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, let me try to explain it again. Under current law, as HCMC is organized under the Charitable Hospitals Act, supervisory personnel do not have the right to organize. Now, what this bill does is it makes a number of governance changes. It takes the organized employees, as was described earlier, mainly AFSCME employees, puts them under PELRA, and makes them essential employees. At the same time that they're trying to maintain, and you may ask the question, why are we treating them as essential employees? The answer is that, quite frankly, I cannot imagine my friends at AFSCME striking HCMC, because their primary concern is patient care, and the idea that AFSCME would actually walk with the most acute patients in the state is inconceivable. So I understand some of the concern that some of my conservative friends are having regarding the protections for the currently organized employees at HCMC. However, when you understand that they're not going to strike anyway, the question is, how do you resolve labor disputes? And that's how they're going to do it. Now, as to the management, they currently don't have the right to strike. And all the bill does is, you know, from their point of view, it may be discriminatory. I understand precisely what they're saying. But from the management point of view and from the HCMC point of view, why should a change in governance lead to more, or the ability of the supervisory employees to be able to organize a union? And where they're coming down is that we want to preserve the status quo ante vis-a-vis the rights of employees to organize and the rights of employees in order to be able to get the contract benefits that they're currently enjoying. So that's how I look at it, Representative Cornish. And one more thing on the record. One of the reasons that this bill has basically been parked for 2 years, just been introduced in various forms and parked, is because both myself and Senator Berglund and others who have been interested in this issue were not interested in imposing a solution. We were interested in providing a venue in which the interested parties would come together and narrow their differences. Occasionally there'd be a little bit of jawboning by myself and others, but basically having the parties come together out of the mutual self-interest. So, you know, are we trying to impose something here, Representative Cornish? You know, that hasn't been the intent, because I'll tell you, I could have gotten this bill out of the House in 30 seconds when we had 81 votes, but we didn't, because it wouldn't have been the right thing to do, because what we're trying to do is build something for the future that works for Hennepin County, works for the patient population, and works for the employees who are there to provide services to the indigent and the poor.
That satisfies me. The one biggest question was what their status was before this change, and so now that it's answered my question.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abrams, on page 35 of the bill, it says once this becomes a corporation, Hennepin Healthcare System, a public corporation with respect to employees, paramedics, emergency medical tech, if the corporate board establishes alternative retirement plans for certain classes of employees of the corporation and certifies the employees to be excluded from the future retirement coverage, what's that new language speaking to? Maybe your testifier could tell me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, what that refers to is some language that says that all current employees are going to be in PERA when the new corporation forms. All new employees, after the date of the formation of the new subsidiary, will be in PERA with the possible, not necessary, but the possible exception of managers, supervisors, physicians, and certain independent medical practitioners who are entitled to bill for their services. A nurse practitioner would be an example of that. But it would probably be something like 85% of the new employees that were hired after the formation of the corporation would still certainly be in PERA.
Okay, thank you.
Further discussion of the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
I just want to support this bill, not only because Mr. Abrams is bringing it, and I take great credence in his approach to it, but I also know firsthand of the great stewardship responsibilities that both Commissioner Johnson and Mr. Sparks have played to the county and to this hospital. It is one of the significant assets of this metro area, and I know both of them and other board members have gone to great lengths to protect the citizenry and this great institution. So I just encourage everybody to continue to support that effort.
If there's no further discussion to the bill, the chair will renew his motion that House File 2187 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to civil law. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Abrams. And testifiers. The next bill on the docket is the Senate file, 879, Representative Hosh. Welcome, Representative Hosh. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move Senate File 879 to pass onto the consent calendar.
Okay, it's been moved that Senate File 879 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar. Proceed, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File
879... Oh, I'm sorry. I got my wires crossed here. I understand we can't put this on consent.
We can't.
So general register will have to be. Sorry about that.
Okay. This bill did go through the Senate on the consent calendar and has passed already, but general register would be fine.
Okay. You may proceed.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 879 is a relatively simple bill. This is something that came to light in the last election when I was mayor of St. Joseph, and where I thought it was pretty ridiculous that we were holding our three precincts open during primary elections in which we had no contested races at all, whether it was the presidency, congressional race, or any local races. All this bill does is saying that if there's a non-contested primary, that our local municipalities do not have to have their polls open for that primary election. If it was determined that there was a non-contested primary, the municipal clerk or the county auditor would have to post 15 days notice that there would not be a primary election and also have to give that notice to the state auditor. This bill should save significant amount of money for all of our local governments. Just one example, one of my townships in my district had 10 voters that came for the primary election. Six of them were election judges. So they only had four. And when you count that, they spent over $500 per vote for that primary election. We don't want to put money on votes because it's important for our democratic process, but when we're not really determining any particular outcome other than what would happen anyways, it just makes sense for us to streamline things a little bit and not to have this requirement for our local municipalities. This has gone through the Senate. It passed on the floor, 64-1, and I hope the committee can support my bill.
Questions for Representative Hosh?
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Garofalo.
I guess more of a question for staff. Why can't we go to the consent calendar with this? Is there a conflict or controversy?
The chair has, our real chair has requested that this not be placed on consent.
Okay. Has the real chair left any instructions as to why?
I'm sure there's a 45-minute explanation.
Let the record show that was Representative Sharon, okay? That was Representative Sharon who said that. That wasn't me. But does any, does anyone know? Again, Mr. Chairman, I reviewed this bill last evening. I've racked my brain here the last 5 minutes trying to figure out what conflict there could be.
There must be a good reason. I can't tell you what it is.
Okay.
In due to the respect of the chair, I do not want to contest that too much. I believe this is a common sense bill, and that this will pass the floor as it has in the Senate. Just one more thing of clarification also. This is a question that I happened to ask previously, is that our primary elections do not allow write-ins, so we are not causing any receding of the democratic process, really.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing that no one wishes to testify, any further discussion? If not, all in favor of Senate File 879 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Posh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The last bill on our schedule is House File 1068, Representative Howes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like this sent to rules.
The chair will move that House File 1068 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Rules Committee. Representative Howes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. 2 years ago, when we originally came forward with a bill similar to this, we had a great deal of opposition. It was very controversial, and now we no longer have opposition, and hopefully it's not controversial. What we're talking about is common interest community ownership of plots when it comes to lakeshore property. We want, before they're sold, split off and sold independently, that a review by whatever local government has authority over that piece of lakeshore, if it's not in a city, if it's in a township, then it would be the county, to make sure that it complies with all the ordinances regulating shoreline within that community. We've found in the past that without that, I'll give you an example on Leech Lake, there were six lots, 50 feet apiece, 300 foot of lakeshore, pristine property on Leech Lake. Each one had a trailer home with its own well and septic. They were subdivided and sold over the counter. Consequently, none of the owners can get permits to do anything except stay as is. They can't remove the trailer and put up a cabin. They can't remodel. They can't add on. They can't do anything. So this is not only something I think that's good for the lakeshore, but it's something that's good for the customer that were to buy one in the future, would know then whether or not it meets current regulations. And if it doesn't, they have to be aware that they can never remodel or add on. So that would give them the option of not buying it. So this is also a buyer beware piece of legislation. And I am here by myself. I do not have my high-powered lobbyist with me, but I'll muddle through it as best I can if you have difficult questions.
Questions for Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Howes. It just seems to make so much sense, so I'm just kind of curious why it was controversial before and is not now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, when you get the Lakes Association drafted the bill and made it as careful and as detailed as they could, and fortunately the trial attorneys were very upset with how the detail they had, and in working with them, they made some changes, and they made it very simple to the point as to what we wanted done without any fringe on the side, and Trial PAC agreed that this is a good piece of legislation. The current CIC laws, when they were put together over many years and with a great deal of detail, and I think they had a sense of ownership, and they didn't want any changes, but they agreed that this change is probably needed, and it makes common sense.
Representative Howes, could you give us a kind of a typical example of what transaction this is attempting to regulate?
Well, I just did, Mr. Chairman. At Leech Lake, six lots, 300 foot of lakeshore, 50 foot lots. They were sold over the counter. They went to get permits to remodel or do anything, whatever it was they wanted, and they don't comply. They're non-compliant. They can't do anything. They are stuck with what they have. They cannot remodel. They cannot move the trailer home. Well, they can move the trailer home, but then they have an empty lot. But they don't comply not only with county ordinances. If they were in a city, they probably wouldn't comply with city ordinances, and obviously they don't comply with DNR Lakeshore ordinances either. But because they were in existence and they were a common interest community, they could be sold individually and without going through any local government unit or any government unit that had regulations regarding shoreline. This simply will say that before they are sold, during the course of the time that they subdivide and convert them, that local government will be consulted to make sure they comply. And it doesn't even say in this language that local government can say you can't subdivide and sell them, but they're telling them, if you buy it, buyer beware. You're not compliant, you can't do anything with it other than what it is, the way it sits.
Well, I guess I'm surprised that local governments can't already do this. You're saying that current, under current law, they cannot do this? They cannot review this?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an attorney, and I'm starting to sense that I probably should have my powerful lobbyist, but no, because these sales are made over the counter, and evidently, because of how they're made, there is no oversight. It's a common interest community. They're already each individual. They're not like a bunch of townhomes, and you sign an association when that's put into place. And if you were to have a bunch of condos and you form an association, you would go through the local government. You go through the local process.
Mm-hmm.
They'd make sure that everything was compliant. But because these were done so long ago, there is no such approval from local governments at the time that these were put together. I hope I'm explaining this right.
So these lots, let's say, or parcels, were assembled sometime before.
Correct.
They were platted originally as separate parcels, and now somewhere along the way they were collected together?
They were formed as a common interest community, but yet separate. You could buy into this common interest community. But unfortunately, and you could also subdivide. Unfortunately, when you have a 50-foot lot on Leech Lake with a septic tank and a well and a trailer, you cannot. They don't comply. 50-foot lots, number one, are too small.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the septic probably doesn't comply. The well doesn't comply. The trailer home doesn't comply. They can't do anything except what's there. They can own it. They can live there, but they can't really change anything.
Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative House, then the language that the landowner is now submitting to the local government, whether it's the township or the county, to say, we would like to have your permission to do such and such or whatever with my property and get the approval. Is there any type of a guideline or a process by which the individual landowner or the plot owner has to go through, or is that already in local government guidelines?
Representative House.
Well, before you subdivide the land, and you see, even if you sell it over the counter, you just go to the county recorder, and the county recorder will look at this and see whether or not it's been approved by the local unit of government.
Right.
If not, they will not approve the sale. Then you go to the local unit of government. This is what we're doing. And if the local unit of government wants to approve this, which they will not if they don't comply with existing shoreline regulations, they won't approve it. So that means that the six lots on Leech Lake, 300 feet, might have to be five lots at 60 feet, and somehow we're going to lose one of those. I don't know if that would necessarily be the case, but that might be what the city will tell them. City will tell them, this is how you have to comply.
Mr.
It doesn't prevent them, Representative, from selling it, but the owner can't do anything with it. They need to know. They need to beware.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Howes, I think I'm like Representative Lane. I thought they could already do that and go to your local and say, you know, this is what we're going to do, and get turned down just as much as you're saying. It sounds like the language will do the same thing as right now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm sure they can go to the local unit of government. They don't have to. They can sell it to an owner that is not aware. Over-the-counter sale. There's nothing in law, current law, statute that says the county recorder can't file that sale. That's a done deal, and then they find out that it doesn't comply. The problem with the bill I have, it is so simple that it's hard to believe it's so simple. But it's the same. Before they record it, the city has to look at it and say, yeah, this is good, or no, it's not good. Sorry, it's that simple, but it really is.
Further discussion. Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fowl, I was just wondering how large of a problem this is. How many of these CICs are in the state? And is this very, you know, very much an issue for a lot of folks, or is it, what's the magnitude?
Representative Fowl.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanderson, and I'll only make an educated guess, but I suppose in my district it could be anywhere from 25 to 105. When you have as many lakes as I do, and as many lots that were bought in the 20s, 30s, 40s, all the way through the 60s without very little regulation, and all the different ways they put buildings or trailers or cabins on these lots, there are a lot of them. Now, if a developer goes in with a PUD, that's a whole different story. They got to go through all kinds of hoops with government. But we're talking about common interest community, which is a whole different ballgame from PUDs. And while we don't want to get as technical as PUDs, we simply want, before they subdivide and sell these, that the city has a chance to say, hey, they comply or they don't comply. And we have a lot of them. So if we have that many in my district, I would imagine statewide there's a whole lot of them. Mm-hmm. I know another gentleman that has 1,300 feet on Leech Lake with a whole lot of cabins, but he bought the whole thing, the whole resort, and he's not going to ever change it. He just wants it to stay the way it is. So, you know, that's not a problem. He's aware. But if he were to sell each cabin, he would have a problem with complying.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Yeah, I guess I understand the reason for the bill. I wasn't aware that these community of interest communities existed, and so I'm assuming that this was trailer parks and large resorts, and then the owner could convert it to a CIC, and then he could sell each of those units to an unaware buyer under this, and they would act to take care of the real estate taxes and insurance and all those things. But the minute that owner of that leasehold interest decided that they were going to break from the pack, and that's the whole issue. And I can see why this is needed, because you have a lot of those out there, and you have no way to control them otherwise. Or you have, I guess you can control them, but the buyers that are buying these things are stuck with what they get.
Mr. Chairman, the representative is very close to correct. Again, not being an attorney, I'll say you're correct. But some attorney would probably say you missed something. I hope you don't have any attorneys.
As far as you know, you are correct.
For the record, the reason I asked that it be sent to rules, this bill was heard in a timely fashion. It was heard in civil law early Monday afternoon before floor session was supposed to be sent to the floor and then sent to this committee. That didn't happen. It was an error, and it didn't move along the process. I did not know about it until I went to the chairman and asked for a hearing. He said, well, the floor didn't send it over here. So I discussed it with Eric Paulson,
And he said, send it to Rules and we'll take that into consideration. That doesn't guarantee they'll send it to the General Register. I have to fight there too.
If there's no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 1068 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Rules Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I understand this is your last committee of the session? No, it's not. Oh, okay. I was going to congratulate you on the work well done, but we'll wait until you're not.
Okay.
Thank you.
That concludes our agenda. Any instructions from staff as to what our next agenda will be here? Okay. Well, we've got another meeting scheduled, do we not?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I just ask what's the topic? I'm considering that all the policy bill deadlines have passed.
For the next meeting?
Yeah.
Clean water and legacy again. I don't know. More on clean water legacy.
But, yeah.
Okay.
He has not shared that with me, so I don't know what
the
else.
Station is my guess, but
yeah,
we could take a lottery, Representative.
Well, I take it from my standpoint that the annexation issue is something that will have to be addressed by us during the interim. And
do we have a date set for the next meeting?
Wednesday. With that, we stand adjourned.